asked about stories, particularly embarrassing ones. I think I'll save those for another time. But I do, I remember fondly, of course, my time with Brian. Such a good guy, or such a veneer of a good guy, anyway. He did teach me to play Go, but didn't teach me anything more than how to play, and never let me win. He and I played basketball. We had a friendly rivalry on a few fronts, but we went through some difficult times. I mean, it was a difficult place, a difficult teacher in a lot of different ways. And I sometimes reflect on that, that old phrase, no mud, no lotus. We we had a lot of mud, so hopefully we can grow some lotuses too. It's great to be here. It's great to be in a Vipassana center. I mostly traffic in the Zen, in Zen places. We in the Zen school, I feel kind of honestly kind of embarrassed. We cavalierly jettisoned so much of the old school, so much of the original Buddha's teaching. And I think there are reasons for that. I think it was the way we did it wasn't very nice, and it also wasn't very smart. In Japan, for instance, and you don't study the Pali Sutras, the suttas, and we didn't either at Mount Baldy, did we, Brian? Not a, we didn't study the Eightfold Path. It's remarkable, actually. So I'm interested in reconnecting, and Brian's helped me do that. To the old school. A Japanese monk once pointed out to me that in Japan, everything is served in its own bowl or on its own plate separately. No food touches another food. Whereas in China, they make a big stir fry, and in America, we like that style too. I mix my mashed potatoes with my peas. And I think there's something to that style of mixing. I think it's helpful, important to learn your whatever tradition you're learning, your root tradition, down deep. And I also think that we can learn a lot from each other. So I call Brian when I have questions about the old ways, and I always learn a lot from him. He's really well placed, I mean, perfectly placed for me because he knows the Zen school well and he knows Vipassana down deep now. So I also, in my humble opinion, he is a good and thoughtful and principled teacher, and which is not saying nothing. You probably know this, but you got a good one. Anyhow, this summer I have been thinking about, as along with everybody else, about racism and bias. And I've been thinking about the way in which we regard others, and especially the person who we might be disinclined to like, or another, a person from another tribe or another group. And how our Buddhist practice helps us address that. So here are some thoughts, and I hope you find one or two of them, or half of them, helpful. So, guy walks into his doctor, and he says, "Doc, I don't know what's the matter with me. I touched myself here, I hurt. I touched myself here, I hurt. I touched myself here, I hurt." Doctor says, "Sir, I think you have a broken finger." I heard that joke on the Prairie Home Companion joke show that my mother would send me as a little cassette tape when I was a monk. And I thought, now there is a Buddhist joke. I think we humans have a reflexive tendency to think that the problem is over there, that it's that and that and that, that our problem is our parents or our boss or that one annoying guy. And I think that those are problems, to be sure, but there is also a real problem with the perceiving finger. And I think Buddhism and the Zen school say that the way we perceive things is actually our most fundamental problem. So this practice of ours, it's a common practice that we have, I think, it gives us a chance to heal that finger. And that it makes us better at perceiving things clearly and correctly. I think we can see people and situations better from different angles with less knee-jerk bias or discrimination. And that then affects the way we treat others, the way we work with situations, which helps everyone. I'd say Buddhism in general, in Buddhism in general, we start with ourselves rather than with others. There's a Zen phrase that Master Rinzai uses that has always stuck with me. Turn your light around and shine it on yourself. In Zen, and I imagine in Vipassana too, we start with meditation, which is the primary way that we investigate ourselves and the way we perceive things. So, as I see it, first we find calm. We breathe. We breathe from our belly calmly, and we now know that our parasympathetic nervous system kicks in when that happens and tells us that we're okay. That though we may imagine danger is lurking in our future, if we don't think, lurking, if we don't make the right move, or if we don't make the right decision, there is no danger lurking right now in this room, in this moment. Brian said, look around the room. It looks okay. I like to use the Buddhist phrase, present moment awareness, for this becoming aware of this present moment rather than future moments or past moments. So we calm ourselves in meditation. And then when we're really calm, we can find a place of no thinking. This is something that the Zen school stresses or talks about a fair amount, or at least less thinking. Zen school says if we, and I think Buddhism in general, if we get quiet enough, desireless enough, we'll find a place of no thinking. And in Zen language, we call that place, that always present aspect of ourself, Buddha nature. The place that doesn't have to think, the aspect of ourselves that doesn't have to think. So it's possible to drop our need, our compulsive need to worry or to plan, or even to want anything at all. I think that's what meditation leads us to, or can lead us to. We can drop our compulsive need to think or to judge anything. We can get calm enough not to prefer anything, not to prefer one thing over another. Any sight or sound or feeling or any outcome. So Zen says, just don't judge anything. See what that feels like. Just allow it to be. Just sense things without any thought or judgment. And we call that a place of non-discrimination. One of the most famous Zen poems is called Song of Faith Mind. Some Zen centers chant it. It's by our third ancestor. And I'm going to quote a little bit from it here. The great way is only difficult for those who pick and choose. Do not like, do not dislike, and all will be clear. Even slightest distinctions made set earth and heaven far apart. If you would clearly see the truth, be neither for nor against. The battle between for and against is the mind's worst disease. The corollary, I think, in Vipassana or in Theravada Buddhism would be no grasping, no aversion, no picking, no choosing, no liking, no disliking. No attraction for or aversion against. And I think in that deep place of calm, and now I'm talking about something deeper than calm, we can give up the need to be for or against. That calm place allows that. You don't have to be for or against the itch that you have or the hum of the computer or the truck that drives by, or the sound of the birds. You don't have to be for or against the way you acted yesterday, or for or against a difficult relationship, or an outcome. We let all of that fall away, and we're left just with this moment without a positive or negative charge. That's non-discriminating mind. That's zero. Not being for or against things, just letting them be as they are. There's a book that I like, read it a few years ago. Haven't read it since, really. Well, once since. By the evolutionary psychologist Jonathan Haidt, called The Righteous Mind. Can't remember the subtitle now. And though he's not a Buddhist, he uses exactly that quote from the Song of Mind, Song of Faith Mind, in his introduction. So, of course, I liked him immediately. And he says that if we want to loosen the roots of our self-righteousness, the fixed, hardened views that we know just what's right and what's wrong, with a person or with a situation, then we should learn to go to this place of neither for nor against. If we want to loosen the reflexive tendency that we have to see a person in an out group, for instance, as bad, someone I have little in common with, then we should go to this place that doesn't have attraction or aversion. And I agree. I think that not being for or against allows us to loosen the for or against knee-jerk instinct that we have. Our instant categorization of everything into things that we like and things that we don't like. I think the state of non-discrimination, which we can find underneath calm, helps us loosen the way that we categorize people or discriminate against them often because of one characteristic that they have. If it's a characteristic that we dislike, especially if we strongly dislike it or are suspicious of it, then that becomes very quickly all that we can see of that person. That person narrows to simply that and becomes a kind of cartoon version of the person, not the complex person that they truly are, that all of us truly are. And you know, when somebody is mean to me, or I feel has wronged me in some way, and they write me an email, or I see them in the Thriftway, the grocery store here, the one grocery store we have on the island where everybody goes to shop. We really live in a small town, for better and worse. That person tends to narrow to a person who has wronged me. That is what I see, unless I relax into and remember. And it's too easy to not to see other sides of a person, I think. I think we all can feel that. I certainly can when in my daily life. So Haidt says he would not want to live in that state of neither for nor against all the time. And that's what we say too in the Zen school. In Zen practice, the state of for or against is seen as temporary. We need to feel it, what it's like, and then we need to leave it. It's a place of tranquility, but it's not one that lasts. So I was taught you cannot stay in heaven. There are no restaurants or bathrooms there. You have to leave. We become quiet and calm in our practice, and we see if we can find a place that's beyond for or against, that is a place of non-discrimination. And then ourself inevitably appears again, and it's time to make distinctions again and choose where to go to dinner, what to have for dinner. But we're different for having been there, for having touched that world. Or, I mean, actually, I mean, touch that world is one way to put it, but having visited that aspect of ourselves. And I think when done in the context of community and teaching, this practice really can lead us to an attitude which is less quickly and rigidly categorizing, one that doesn't rush to judgment about people, and that steers us away from a kind of self-righteousness. I think the tendency to categorize people and things and situations comes up so quickly, so automatically, that you know, without even having the space to question it, that it tends to blind us to other aspects of that other person or the other thing. Anybody know Robert Wright? Wrote a book called Why Buddhism Is True. He came to visit our island. We asked him, and he gave a talk here. He's a author mostly on evolutionary psychology and books about evolutionary psychology. And in this book, Why Buddhism Is True, he talks about a moment late in a meditation retreat where he sees a plantain weed, which is an old enemy of his at home. You know, he'd spent hours battling this plantain weed in his garden with his hands and spades, and finally weed killer. And yet now, deep in the into the retreat, he sees it completely differently. It's beautiful. He sees a field of it, and it's just gorgeous in the afternoon sun. He looks at one in particular, beautiful. In fact, it's no longer a weed. Or more precisely, and in Zen speak, it's both a weed and not a weed at the same time. I think when we have a fixed category, for the fixed category of weed, we can't see other aspects of weed. It's only when we drop our categories, when we drop our names for things, that we can see more of that, more aspects come alive. And also, of course, with people too. When we have fixed categories for someone, we do not see the whole person. So, I think our practice gives us a tool to see things more clearly, more broadly, with a non-discriminating mind. And I think that's true. However, I think we have to work at it. It doesn't come automatically. And we have to get used to using that mind, even in difficult situations. In his commentary to the Heart Sutra, we studied the heart, this commentary this spring, Thich Nhat Hanh has a story about the Buddha and Mara. Mara comes to visit Buddha. Now, I wrote Brian last year about this story and said, you know, where does this story come from? And Brian said, it doesn't come from anywhere that I know of. So Thich Nhat Hanh probably made this up, or maybe he adapted it from one of the hundreds of tall tales that, you know, that he, Buddhist tall tales, that are out there. It does remind me, actually. Yeah, I never care whether things happen or not. I mean, what interests me is, like, why they last. This is a little nerdy, but there's a guy who wrote a book called Seeing Through Zen, and he had John McRae. He has like four rules of studying Zen, and the second rule is, if it didn't happen, it's more important. So anyway, this didn't happen. Mara comes by the Buddha's hut, knocks on the door. Oh my God, Ananda's there. Ananda, the Buddha's faithful servant, or, you know, attendant. And he's like, his head explodes. Oh my God, it's Mara. And so he says, you know, get out of here. Shoo, go away. Mara, if those of you who don't know, you know, is in a pretty fixed category of bad. The bad one. The one who is trying to stop the Buddha from becoming enlightened at every point. So get lost. And the Buddha overhears this and the commotion from the back room, and being the Buddha, he is not flustered at all. He says, come on in, Mara. Let's have tea. Well, Ananda is greatly annoyed and worried, but he fixes them tea. And at tea, Mara starts complaining. He says, you know, it's hard to be Mara, Buddha. I have to talk in riddles all day. And I've got all this pressure to look evil all the time. And my disciples, they're a lot of trouble. They're interested in this, that, and the other. Nonviolence now. Maybe you should take them all. And Ananda's like, oh my God. And the Buddha says, well, let me tell you, Mara, it's no picnic for me either. I mean, my disciples, they're always quarreling. They build these stupas that I don't even want. They don't listen to me. So they have a big old laugh, Mara and Buddha. And then Mara gets up and peacefully leaves. I mean, what a great story. And I think, of course, we all have an Ananda. within us. Don't let that dude in. And we all have a Buddha. Come on in, let's talk. I was reflecting on that and wondering, like, what is it that gives the Buddha the guts to let Mara in for tea? I'm guessing that his sitting practice doubtless helped him. He knows well that non-discriminating mind that I was just talking about, and lets it have some space in his consciousness. I'm guessing that his intuition, based on his sitting practice and his study, tells him that humans are not cartoons, that Mara is not a cartoon either, that they are complex. And I imagine he sees many sides of a person at a glance, even Mara. And I wonder if he sees it also as a kind of duty to meet Mara when he happens to come by. I feel that kind of duty as a Buddhist, to do that when I can. I should say there are times when I can't, there's times when I shouldn't, when it's better to leave Mara at the door. There's only so much we can do. We have to take care as well. But I think we have to practice not just on the cushion. We have to practice this non-discrimination, this kind of non-discrimination, not just on the cushion, but also out in life. To notice our prejudices, to notice how quickly they come up, and to question them. I think we have to practice meeting with others that we may be skeptical of, or maybe from a tribe we don't like. I think we have to, I really think it's our duty as Buddhists. Is that a terrible word, duty? I think it's okay. It's not always easy. My wife and I have a meditation supply business. We didn't know what to do when we left Mount Baldy. And I wanted to just get a job, like at a nonprofit or something. My wife wouldn't have it. She wanted us to just move here and see what happened, which I thought was a big mistake. And but what we did, of course. And then somebody was giving away a meditation supply business. So anyway, so we did that, and now we've done it. And now we've done it for 20 years. A few years ago, we were hiring. This was our second employee, but we only had one employee at a time. And so we saw a bunch of people and we chose Mary. Mary's not a real name. And it was an easy choice. She was interested, she was careful, she was quick. And on the first day I on the job, I told her she's welcome to meditate with me on the clock. We do that for 15 minutes. And she said, oh no, thank you. I won't be doing that. I don't meditate. I'm a member of the church next door. My heart sank. Church next door is an evangelical, the most evangelical church on the island. Fundamentalist evangelical. And alarm bells went off in my head. I was just like Ananda. And I told my wife, Lidun, who's Norwegian, you know, born and bred in Norway. I told her, I don't think this is going to work out. I mean, she's going to have to handle these Buddhas. She's going to have to memorize all these Japanese names, you know, Zen names for things, answer the phone. And I told my wife, I said, I grew up with these guys in the South. You don't know these guys. And my wife said, well, you know, honey, it doesn't look that way to me. She chose the job. And then, I mean, I still remember the feeling I had at that moment. Wow, I'm the bigot here. I thought those guys were the bigots. I really had to admit, like, it was a humbling moment. And one of many that have taught me to respect the strength and the alacrity of the discriminating mind. And of course, Mary was a fantastic coworker, and one of our best, for sure. And I'm still friends with her on Facebook. She still likes our stuff, though it's been many years. And since then, just to make an even more Hollywood ending, I've made friends with the minister next door, Mike, and we are kind of buds. And we read and discussed the book that I just mentioned, The Righteous Mind, together. I think that our practice, our Buddhist practice, can help anyone combat narrow, fixed views of people. And I think it can help us combat sexism and racism and ableism. I think that it should also teach us that quickly categorizing people is very easy to do, and that it takes active work to overcome. Doing meditation is not enough. In the Zen school, sometimes it sounds like that. I won't go down that road, but we can tend to be very romantic about the effects of meditation. It's not enough. I think any people who do deep meditation for long times can be, in some areas, judgmental, biased, stuck in our views. So I think part of our work is to actively examine ourselves, to think as well as to not think, with the help of our Buddhist context, of our, you know, teachers and Dharma and Sangha, and to get out there and test ourselves. And in general, I think I can say that Zen helps most in the interplay between thinking and non-thinking, between self and no self, between discriminating mind and non-discriminating mind. And that's what allows our character to develop. It allows us to see and think and act more clearly and helpfully and wisely. And in Buddhism, in order to help ourselves through life and to help other people through their lives, we turn our light inward first. We work on fixing our perception by calming ourselves, by dropping our thinking self, and finding a place without attraction or aversion, without for or against. And then I think that allows us to regard others more accurately and in a more broad-hearted and compassionate way.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.